Hello and welcome to season 4 of Medical Women Talking. My name is Jane Dacre and I've been privileged to listen to the career stories of these inspiring colleagues. These women have all made an impact and many of them have overcome barriers in their careers. From them, you will learn that we all have setbacks and barriers in our careers, but what defines us is how we cope with this, which is part of life.
So today I'm speaking to Professor Jenny Higham. So Jenny has followed an academic career track and is the Vice Chancellor of St George's, which is part of the University of London and has a large healthcare faculty. So Jenny, we're going to talk about your career. So you started off in medicine and then went into obs and gyne, but then have moved into a completely different area. So can I start by asking you why you went into medical, why you went into medicine in the first place?
I came from an extremely ordinary background. My older sister went to university the year before me, but my parents were, my dad was an engineer, but he got his qualification through night school, and my mum was deaf, partially deaf, and came from an extremely impoverished background. So they really realised the value of education, but for them, the opportunity of going to university simply wasn't there. I was very ill when I was a kid, probably about 8 years of age, and I got glomerulonephritis and went to bed as you did then, and it for a month, and as a very active kid that was really noteworthy. And during that time there was a fantastic local GP that came to visit, and I basically was going to get better or not, I suppose, in a way, but he was a wonderful individual, and I always remember him drawing a little cartoon for me once, and about a man drinking a bottle, and he was actually very inspiring. And I also was naturally really interested in science and how the body worked and so on. And so at that stage I decided that I really would like to become a doctor.
How old were you?
About eight.
You say about eight. So yeah. quite young.
And then something that I won't go into any detail of was I then had the most riotous time as a teenager. And to be honest with you, academia so completely slipped, but I had the most fabulous time. And some of the experiences I had then, I would say, have been some of the most fun of my life, but not compatible with good grades. And so I nearly didn't go into the sixth form because of my disruptive behaviour. But there was a wonderful man, the headmaster, who, for reasons, I was at a grammar school, he knew me and got to know me for the wrong reasons. And there was a bit of opposition, I think, and for me going into the sixth form.
So when you say for the wrong reasons, because you were badly behaved?
Yeah. And but the wonderful Fred the Head, he always used to be referred to by your surname, he stuck out for me and he said, Higham, you're really annoying, but I think you're bright. And he allowed me into the sixth form against some opposition. And so to just complete that loop, years later, when I graduated from UCL and I got the top award, the Atchison Scholarship for Performance, I actually wrote to him, because he'd retired by then, I didn't know the letter would reach him, and I said, I just want to say thank you so much for supporting me then, and I just wanted you to know that, you know, you might have wondered whether you better paid off, but it has. And he actually did write back to me, and he died not long after that. But I'd always been so thrilled that I'd actually closed that loop.
What a lovely story.
So I got to the stage of doing in the sixth form. So we're back in the sixth form then. And to be honest with you, expectations of me were not as high as other people, because Fred the Head had faith, but I think a lot of other people didn't. And so I did had some careers advice. And they said to me, oh, you might be managed to be a dietitian, because I'm interested. And so they gave me some work experience, and I went to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital. And I met a dietitian, and I, again, crystal clear memory of this event. And she was morbidly obese, frankly, and quite chummy. And I love people. And we ended up having a really nice conversation, but it totally backfired in terms of selling the career. After this very nice conversation about her day-to-day life, the two things that she said to me were, she said, let me tell you a really good thing. She said, the really important thing, you know, is actually what we do doesn't really make a difference. It's the doctors that make a difference to whether people live or die. And I thought, I'm not going to bother doing a career that doesn't really make that much difference. And then just as I was leaving, she says, I want to show you something. And so she undid the bottom drawer of her desk and she says, we keep our knitting in here. And so if it's quiet in the afternoons, we do a few rows. And I said, thank you so much. And I got up and I left and I thought, no way, Jose. And even though she was a nice person, I just thought, forget it. And of course, now dietetics and the whole field has completely expanded. But that was my experience. And because I'd not made the right choices, I hadn't got chemistry anyway. And so I was having to crunch chemistry, having not done the O level. And so I was back in my chemistry classes, having had this experience. And there were a couple of the bright boys who were going to apply for medicine. And they would ask questions and I wouldn't say it. But I suddenly thought, the answer to that is obviously this. And the answer to that is obviously that. And it was a moment of self-revelation that if they were the bright boys applying to medicine, that even though I appear to have, you know, missed my opportunity, actually I should reappraise that. And so I did go on to get my A levels, but didn't have the right combination for medicine. And then became very determined that I was going to do it. And so went to work in Argos for a year and went to the City College. And again, I wanted to get an A level that would allow me to apply for medicine. And I went to the City College and they said, we don't do physics. Well, we were living in Norwich at that time because we moved around the country with my dad's job. And he said, we don't do A levels in a year. And there was this bloke there telling me why not. So I leant over the desk and picked up his two timetables. And I said, look, if I do all of this, which is the second year of the course, and I do these four other classes, I can cover the curriculum in the year. And he said, oh, all right then, you know. And so they, again, this slightly difficult or, you know, unusual creature. So I joined five different classes, the final year completely with one class and all, a whole random range of other classes, and also worked on the tills in Argos.
Full-time?
Sorry? No, part-time. So I did, they loved me at Argos. In fact, they did want me to do management training at Argos. So that basically made it a full-time occupation. And I got an offer from UCL, as long as I got a grade C in this physics A level. And in the end, I got a B and off I went.
And so what other A levels had you done?
Home economics, chemistry and biology.
Okay, and then physics was the one that you were missing. Do you think it made any difference when you got there?
No, of course it did. I mean, you know.
So you then went to UCL. How was that?
Really disappointing. I really didn't enjoy the first couple of years of university. I mean, that's an exaggeration. I had the most amazing teenager. I had fantastic friends, a much older boyfriend, you know, been to Led Zeppelin concerts on the back of motorbikes, you know, lived a lot, let's just say it that way. And I got to university and there were all these people who'd never had a drink or sort of been really hot housed. And I had really lived, shall we say, by the time I got there. And so it wasn't this amazing freedom awakening. It was, and also the former programs within medicine, as you know, were intensely theoretical. And I am not, I can do it just about well enough, but I'm not super bright at that stuff. And so it was intense and it was dry. So I wondered whether it had been the right thing. It socially lovely, met some nice people, lots of international students, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't, and I loved London. London was the most amazing thing. And my love affair with London continues to this day. But I do remember feeling it really wasn't that great. And it was only when I progressed into the clinical years of the programme that all of a sudden it was great.
I think that's quite common for people of our generation, isn't it? That they struggled a bit with the first 2 years because of them being a bit dull. I hope it's better now. So how about the clinical? How did you get on there? And how did you decide on your postgraduate direction of travel?
I, as I say, the minute that I stepped onto the ward, it made entire sense. And there are many stories I could recount, but I love doing practical things with my hands. I've always loved that, you know, the cooking element, sculpting, anything that's creative with your hands and art were really interesting to me. So not surprisingly, perhaps, I was quite interested in a surgical career. And I went to a surgical at the BMA, actually, a surgical fair. And there was nobody else on the stand, and I approached him, and he wouldn't even talk to me. And I said, "Hello, I'm interested in a career in surgery." And he just turned around and said, "You're female, forget it." And I was also very good. I loved assisting and being in theatre, and terrible sexism. I mean, literally, don't bother to give her a swab. The only thing she'll do with it is wipe her dress. You know, just so even though I loved it, it was quite a barrier. You know, you were in no doubt as to how tough that was going to be. And then I did obs and gynae as my very last rotation. And I arrived, and all of a sudden I felt as though I'd arrived at home. I liked these people. They were quite earthy. They weren't too intellectual. You know, they didn't really care about the alpha trypsin subunit, which was 0.2 removed, you know, all that stuff, which I'm no good at. These people were people, big picture, pragmatic, but also they did things with their hands. They delivered babies, they sewed up bottoms, they did surgery. And as opposed to your gender being completely negative, it was wonderful. You walked into the room and said, "Oh, thank goodness." And having had some very dispiriting experiences, the positive experiences I had from the patients in particular in obs and gynae was wonderful.
Okay, so you chose your career in that area. Did you have was it plain sailing once you decided, or did you have any regrets or doubts or issues or barriers?
No, I mean, you know, I never regretted the choice. And I went through fairly smoothly. I had to do research at that stage. Obs and Gynae was tremendously competitive. I knew I wanted to work in a teaching hospital. And so I would need to get an MD or a PhD. I went through basically ticking off the requirements and loved it. And no regrets.
At some stage, you also got interested in education. How did that come about and why?
As always with careers, two things I'll say. Number one, the majority of my career has come from saying yes. And all the time managers say, you must learn to say no. You must say no. Well, I've always sort of done my main job and one or two, three or four side hustles. And so often the side hustle has become extremely important, and if not trumped the day job. And one of the things that happened was I was going to apply. In fact, I had a job lined up at another major teaching hospital in London as a consultant. And I was at St Mary's and a senior lectureship arose. Although I'd done research, I'd done some publications, I never really considered myself to be a clinical academic. But I was encouraged to apply for that because, well, you could always do that for 3 or 4 years and then get an NHS consultant job. And that, again, was a stroke of genius, stroke luck. And it was just at the time that the amalgamation of Charing Cross and Westminster and St Mary's medical schools were coming together. And they needed people to lead on that amalgamation, which was quite touchy. You know, everybody thought that their course was the best and the way they did things was the best. And so I negotiated paediatrics, obstetrics and gynaecology and embryology into a new program called the Human Life Cycle. And that was my first transition into an educational remit.
And you kept the two in parallel?
Yes. Well, gradually, my role within education just became bigger and bigger. I, first of all, was for that part of the course. I then became a year lead. I then became head of exams and assessment at Imperial. I then became the lead of the programme for medicine. Then I became lead for the educational portfolio at the Faculty of Medicine Imperial College, which then gave me a remit, a much broader remit within the university. I then became Director of Institutional Affairs, so I understood much more of the running of the university. And the final huge positive was that we had a relationship, negotiated a contract with Singapore. And I, for 6 years, worked very hard on this project, setting up a new medical school in Singapore. And that sort of consolidated my credentials as an innovative educator. And I was still research active, collaboratively research active, and I also was returned in REF twice.
In OBS and Gynae? No. In education?
In a variety of ways. So my first REF submission at Imperial was a lot about mechanisms for endometriosis, pain, abnormal bleeding, more clinically oriented. And then the second submission was about differential entailment, gendered gaps, ethnicity gaps, and also innovations in education. So I started to work with engineers to look about hybrid simulation. And so it, along with my career that had morphed, my research also morphed.
Okay. And so during that time, I mean, it sounds as if you'd moved into quite a male focused university because Imperial had a background in engineering. were you amongst colleagues that you could relate to? Were you amongst other women, or were you the only female person around?
Well, I think Ops and Gynae's fortunate in the sense that already at the stage that I joined, when I first went, there were only two female consultants in London, but very quickly there were many, many more women. So I didn't feel unsupported or indeed unique in that respect. And I think Imperial College is a very ruthless institution, but also within it, there are some wonderful individuals who are supportive. And, you know, there's one person, Sir Anthony Newman Taylor, and for a while he was from the Brompton, and he led National Heart Lung Institute, and I got to know him. And we also for a while had to together look after the Faculty of Medicine through a turbulent time, and an incredibly wise but supportive and challenging mentor. There are some people you have a nice chat with and you come away feeling it was nice. With Tony, it was great, but he also challenged me, and he also always put a twist, made me think about something differently. And people like that, I think, are really important. So it shouldn't always be fluffy and nice. It should always provoke thought. And then there was another role model that I thought was amazing at Imperial, was Richard Sykes, the rector, I think he was called then. And I thought he had amazing skills for making people feel valued or recognised or acknowledged for such a huge vista. I used to look at the way he operated large crowds, big rooms, big events. And so it was all the negative things that, you know, Imperial is associated with, but amongst them, there were absolute diamonds of people you could learn from.
But you moved on. So moved on to St George's.
Yeah, that's that. And, you know, those people, they weren't. There are also bastards, you know, and there are also, you know, there are also the type of qualities that I have that are very much around interpersonal, are very much about encouraging a team, very much about, frankly, saying what I think rather than being politically, perhaps I'm just too much for some people. And the reason I moved from Imperial, there is one moment, although it was too hurtful to realise I had to move at that point, is there was a very senior person, not the most senior person, but the second most senior person. This is university wide. And we'd had a lot of turbulence with the deans in medicine. They have different titles, but effectively that was it. And I think we were coming up to the choice of the fifth. And as I said before, I'd had a very major role along with others in running the faculty then. Very experienced, knew the way it worked, knew the pitfalls. And so I actually said, oh, to this individual, what about considering, there'd never been a woman, you know, what about, should I get, and he just turned to me and said, oh my God, you, we'd never consider somebody like you. And I think at that second, he corrected himself and said, oh, but of course, we would welcome an application and it will be a very... And it was so shocking, but also it was actually his honest reaction. And it took a while after that, but I realised it was over because I wasn't going to progress. They loved what I did, servicing so many other things, but I was never going to go beyond that at that time with that regime. And it was painful.
Yeah, I have to say, I completely relate to that with my experience at UCL. It's is it what they call the glass ceiling? I don't know. However, George's benefited.
Yeah,
how are things now?
Fantastic. I mean, what a, you know, and as always, you know, you get good days and bad days. But I thought I would see out my career at Imperial. And that had been my mindset. But actually, it's been fantastic. And the key thing that's happened is, even though, you know, George's is perceived to be a lesser institution or whatever by some of the great beer muffs of London, it has been my key to a completely different arena. So I am a vice chancellor. I was a principal. I'm a vice chancellor now. There is some snobbery, of course, in relation to turnover, student numbers, etc. But actually, I am completely in the thick of the country's vice chancellors. I have got a number of senior roles. I've got on the most senior boards within universities. I'm a spokesperson. It's wonderful. And all your colleagues, I mean, there's only two or three of us that are medics. So you're dealing all the time with a complete interdisciplinary mix of other leaders. And I would say that it has been the most fabulous, because I said earlier, although I did medicine, I'm not only interested in medicine, I'm really interested in lots and lots of other things. And so the role that I'm now is, I love the breadth of it and what it exposes me to. For example, specialist institutions is an area, a group within Universities UK, slightly odd. But it's lots of them, lots of artistic, creative, musical, specialist institutions. And we sometimes go to each other's gaffes and have a dinner there, or the opening, or you go to, you know, one of the individuals retired, and we had a fabulous play by the students and tour. And, you know, I feel that there is, I love that, and that is that I find medics often slightly, they're wonderful and they're amazing and they're talented, but there's so much more talent and interest far beyond our own discipline, and I have such access to that,
which is fantastic. We're getting near to the end now. Can I turn a little bit and talk about work-life balance and your family life? Because not only have you had the most stellar career, you've also got three children. How's that been along the way? Have you had to sacrifice family life or relationships or what have you in order to continue at the level that you've been working, which is an extraordinarily high level? Or does it all work out?
It takes an enormous amount of work and organisation and determination. What are the two key things I would say to anybody? Number one, make sure your partner's on the same page, because I've seen people do all those difficult things, but if their partner really isn't supportive of their career or really doesn't think it's the right thing at the moments of crisis, I think it's so, you know, crisis in childcare, illness, various things happening, it makes it doubly difficult to cope. My husband has actually been away for, that's another whole story. He doesn't live or work in London during the week. And so I effectively was also a bit of a single parent. But you constant, and the second thing is you constantly have to be honest about your relationship, what's going on, and what you need and what your demands are. And you can't, in the end, it becomes corrosive if you're not being honest. And just the final thing to finish on about juggling it all is, you probably at some point, most people need to have the, well, I'm in a meeting conversation. So because I'm based in London, because the kids went to school in London, because my husband was away a lot of the time, the default position when anything went wrong or any crisis needed solving, it was always my problem to solve that. And something came up, and probably health or something with one of the kids, or and we were called to a meeting. A parent needed to be there, and it would always be my problem to solve. And so I rang up my husband and I said, oh, we need to, and he says, oh, okay, then. And he said, oh, I can't do that anyway. I've got a meeting. I said, I've got a meeting too. Really? You've got a meeting? Yes, I've got a meeting too. So I think my meeting is just as important as your meeting. So what we're going to do. And it was. It was never going to be completely even. And but it started a dialogue where I thought, put my little foot down and thought, no, you know, why does it always default to me? But on the other hand, I wanted to stay in London. And he was doing all the compromise of doing all the traveling and having to live away from home. So, you know, but long relationships are a constant gardening, tussle, conversation, stimulation, good times, bad times. But the one thing that in the end, if you're going to make it through, you have to have the difficult conversations and you have to work through the problematic times.
Yeah, very wise, very wise. So any particular thing that you would like to say to young women thinking about having the same sort of career as you? Is there anything that you would suggest as a piece of advice to those coming through or thinking about having a high-flying career?
Not in particular, because I do a huge amount of mentoring and supporting others. And actually, I think some of the, I'll give you an example of somebody who I mentored on this program. And we met up. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think she felt as though she had to really big herself up and pretend to be more ambitious than she really was because she was, quote unquote, being mentored by me. That's rubbish. What I want and what I think every person should aim for is to wear the carapace that suits you. And there's no shame or just fine the amount of work. You can work part-time, full-time, the disciplinary area, the amount that you want to be with your kids, you know, all that. There isn't a right and a wrong answer, but it sure is stressful if you're trying to pretend to be something that isn't comfortable with you and what you want and your aspirations. And the only person that can decide that is yourself. And so follow your own heart and guts and go about creating that. Of course, there are some compromises, but in general, that's what I would say. For me, I loathe being underemployed. I love being busy. I am a bit pathetic with my own time and trying to structure it and fill it. I love to go to work. I love to speak to people. So for me, being super busy, lots of external commitments still, but very different, as well as a day job and a bit of clinical, really suits me. But that's because of my personality type. It matches. So really think, what is it that makes you happy? What is it you want to achieve and set about doing it? And you do have quite a lot of autonomy, not so much in the training grade. You need to get your bits of paper. But you do have a tremendous amount of autonomy, I think, in middle to later careers.
Excellent. Fantastic advice. So basically, just be you.
Authenticity.
I think that's a good place to stop.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.